my codes, and streaming was years away. You could only binge on old DVDs, and seasons didn't last one day. But how did we go? The weekly wait was such a tease. With the 2-hour block of shows, travel to Dunder Mifflin, Greendale, TGS, and Pawnee. They stopped calling him a sea, but it was still a beautiful sight. So now I'm talking Comedy Night, and it's podcasted right.
Hello, and welcome to Comedy Night Podcasted Right. I am the one-man band that only plays Halloween music, Matt Kale. On today's episode, we'll be going back to November 5th, 2009, and looking back at the newest episodes on NBC's Comedy Night Done Right, with Community Season 1, Episode 8, Home Economics, Parks and Recreation Season 2, Episode 8, Ron and Tammy, The Office Season 6, Episode 9, Double Date, and 30 Rock, Season 4, Episode 4, Audition Day. Considering I'm now 4 episodes in, I'm getting a feel for what I think does and doesn't work on this show. Last episode got a little dark, and while I don't want to shy away from controversy surrounding these shows, I do want to keep this podcast as light and breezy as possible. So yes, every now and then we're going to have some very special episodes, but I want to keep those few and far between. This podcast is a love letter to these series, and I don't want to lose focus on that. I also never imagined an episode would end up being an hour and a half long. So at least for the next couple episodes, I'm going to tighten up on the runtime and try to keep things to around an hour going forward, although I'll probably be a little bit longer. And some of the segments are already getting a little bit repetitive, so I'm going to shake things up a little bit to avoid getting stale. Like most new shows, I'm just making everything up as I go along and trying to figure out what works best. I'm getting back to basics and really want to explore how interconnected these four different series at entirely different points in their histories could seemingly intersect while airing on the same night. So with that, I'm going to quit wasting tape and get down to business.
This is what everyone watched instead.
Sounding like a broken record, NBC once again lost in the ratings, but they're holding steady. I'm still surprised Community got more viewers than Parks in these early days, with Community getting 5.5 million viewers, while Parks only got 4.9. So it should be interesting to see if and when they flip. The Office came in at 8.1 million, and 30 Rock with 6.1 million. All in all, pretty flat since last week. At 10 o'clock, Leno got 4.8 million. His guests tonight were Wanda Sykes and Rachel Ray. And Ray will play herself next season on 30 Rock's 100th episode. I found 3 articles published on November 5th, 2009, discussing the Jay Leno show. ABC News published, "Is it time to pull the plug on Leno?" The Sheaf published, "Jay Leno is killing television." And the Christian Science Monitor published, "With ratings fall, Jay Leno is everybody's favorite pinata." Not sure what specifically triggered all these articles on this day, but the show had only gotten 3.9 viewers on Monday, its worst night yet. Remember, this aired 5 nights a week in prime time. And considering how NBC was choosing to run this talk show, a show that's cheap to produce, rather than develop other new sitcoms and dramas or reality shows, it was hurting the entire network's reputation. This created a really negative halo effect on Comedy Night Done Right. And even if The Office and 30 Rock were hits, they paled to the massive ratings that shows like Friends, Frasier, and Will and Grace were getting 5 years earlier. On ABC, newcomer Modern Family got 8.8 million viewers the night before. And ABC used to be the pinata. On Monday, November 2nd, CBS's comedy block got 8.8 million viewers for How I Met Your Mother, 8.1 million for Accidentally on Purpose, 13.5 million for Two and a Half Men, and 12.7 for The Big Bang Theory. Comedy could still get big ratings, but just not on NBC. Having only one show that could break 8 million viewers, followed up with the dud of the Jay Leno show, was fuel to the fire that NBC was creatively tapped out. So I'm going to mix up this next part. I never watched these shows, and the plots are all getting pretty repetitive week over week. So unless I see a major star in a crossover, I'm not going to keep spending hours combing through IMDb to look for people with tiny supporting roles on multiple series. So, with the World Series over, Fox was back to regular programming and was back to third place. Bones got 8.7 million viewers at 8, with an investigation around the death of a man who ran an industrial chicken farm.
The minute before you thought about busting us, that was the minute you had chicken in your hand.
Fringe continues to be the only show that can't compete with NBC, with only 4.9 million viewers at 9 o'clock, and featured a plot about a Russian cosmonaut infested with an alien entity.
Looks like this Siberian husky is going to be Russian. Off to jail.
On ABC, Flash Forward hasn't started to tank yet, but I'm waiting for it, and it had 8.7 million viewers tonight. This week featured a suicide cult who are attempting to alter the course of the future that was seen in all the flash forwards.
Hey, guys, listen up. Michael is up on the roof and acting strange.
Grey's Anatomy had 14 million viewers, with Arizona having a conflict of interest after Seattle Grace received a huge donation from the parents of a patient.
Maybe give more than $3 next time.
Yeah, well, $3 a mile is going to end up being like 50 bucks. God, I can't even calculate what you're going to have to give.
Private Practice had 9.1 million viewers, with Naomi struggling with the idea of genetically designing babies.
All pregnancies are hysterical. They're started by penises.
CBS once again smashed everyone else. Survivor, at 8 o'clock, had 12.4 million viewers. Russell Hantz played his immunity idol, even though nobody was going to vote for him anyway.
What a waste. What a waste.
15.6 million people watched CSI, where the team discovered two seemingly unrelated cases are actually intertwined after investigating a fire.
How did this happen? And did I miss the fireman?
Dean, the explanation is simple. It's all connected. A web of conspiracy that goes all the way to the top of Arizona.
All right.
And The Mentalist won Thursday again with 16.2 million viewers. Bosco discovers a bug that Patrick Jane had planted in his office and has Jane sent to prison.
And I never got caught, neither.
Well, you're in prison, but...
I feel like I'm probably going to lean into Prison Mike a lot, since these shows are mostly about people going to prison. Meanwhile, talking stuff I actually watched, over on FX, Always Sunny actually had a decent showing with 1.99 million viewers. Tuning in to see one of the show's instant classics, Patty's Pub, home of the original Kitten Mittens. I completely whiffed on this over the last few weeks, but this episode, along with the World Series defense and the gang wrestles for the troops, were directed by Randall Einhorn, who was the office's director of photography, and he directed 15 offices, 5 Parks and Recs, and 14 Always Sunnies altogether. At 10:30, the league improved from its premiere, coming in at 1.41 million. I glossed over this series last time because I had so much else going on in the episode, but considering how much I do love actor crossovers, the league had so many, and I want to take a few minutes to talk about them. Notably, 3 of the main stars of this show appeared on our other Comedy Night Done Right series. I talked about Paul Scheer 2 episodes ago when he was running Kaboom on Parks and Recreation. Kate Asselton, who plays Jenny, was in The Office Season 5 Blood Drive as Glove Girl. I believe she's giving blood at the same time Michael is. So fun fact about me is that I will faint if I go for blood work, or talk about blood work, or listen to people talk about blood work, or even think about it for this long. So I almost never rewatch Blood Drive, and I'm feeling a little lightheaded right now. Nick Kroll plays Ruxin, and we'll see him again quite a few times. He'll play Jürgen the German foosball enthusiast on Community, and he also appeared 5 times as Pawnee's shock jock radio host. And if you like celebrity gossip, he dated Amy Poehler from 2013 to 2015 after meeting her on the set of Parks. Jason Mantzoukas was a recurring guest star on The League as Rafi, and you might recognize him as Pawnee's cologne magnate Dennis Feinstein, or from his one appearance on Community Season 6 as local theater director Matt Lundergaard. Over its 84 episodes, The League had tons of guest star crossover as well. In last week's premiere, we got an appearance from Matt Walsh, who will play Joshua the Groundkeeper in Season 2 of Community and would later turn up in Parks and Recreation's Emergency Response. Some other notable crossovers as the series went on were Zach Woods, who will come to play Gabe really soon on The Office, appeared in 3 episodes. Aziz Ansari appeared twice, and Andy Buckley, David Wallace, appeared once. And there's dozens of other actors who have had guest spots here on The League and also on the other shows. Tonight was the second episode of the show's 6th episode first season. It would be a Thursday night mainstay on FX through the fall for its first 4 seasons, before moving to Wednesdays on FXX for its final 3 seasons. And while none of tonight's guest stars appeared on any of the other series, Meghan Markle does guest star in an early role when she was a virtual unknown. I wasn't going to mention this at all, but her recent interview with Oprah has probably been the most damaging thing to happen to the British monarchy in a long time, and that is strangely related to what was in the news tonight. And I'd like to point out that I had this entire script written before Prince Philip died, and I'm recording it the day after, and I've chosen to change none of my remaining material.
This is the Comedy Night Podcast at Right Olds. If it was new, we call it news, but it's old, so we call it olds.
I ignore a lot of bad shit that was in the news, mostly because the news is mostly bad shit. And November 5th, 2009 was a pretty terrible day. So instead, to keep things lighthearted, I'm going to switch gears entirely and talk about the British tradition of Bonfire Night, an annual commemoration that is observed in the UK on the 5th of November. It dates back 404 years earlier to 1605, when a group of Catholics attempted to assassinate the Protestant King James I of England by blowing up the House of Lords during the opening of Parliament on November the 5th, using over 36 barrels of gunpowder. However, the whole plot was foiled when the night before, Guy Fawkes was discovered guarding the barrels after an anonymous letter tipped off the authorities. Had this been successful, this would have been a lot more disastrous for the royal family than an interview with Oprah Winfrey. To celebrate the failed attempt, the king allowed the public to celebrate his survival by lighting bonfires. This became an annual tradition, and over the years, this evolved into other traditions like burning Guy Fawkes in effigy and setting off fireworks. How is this holiday being celebrated in 2009? Well, an op-ed piece written by Dave Hill for The Guardian mentioned that the holiday was starting to lose its sparkle, and the pun is fully intended. Halloween, a purely North American holiday, had seeped its way into British culture over the last 10 years, and trick-or-treating was certainly cutting into the celebrations. Meanwhile, fireworks, which traditionally were only a bonfire night treat in the UK, were also widely used during Diwali, and they're used again on New Year's Eve. And considering this was a Thursday, the writer of this piece also mentioned that he was only holding his traditional bonfire on the weekend. The legacy of Guy Fawkes and the gunpowder plot has shifted over the last 400 years. The religious connotations have faded away, and rather than being considered a terrorist, Fawkes has turned into something of a folk hero. In fact, even the word Guy, as a synonym for a fellow, comes from Guy Fawkes. The effigies were referred to as a guy, lowercase g, and eventually a guy was a character of ill repute. But even that's faded away, and now guys has to be one of the most common ways to informally refer to a group of people. Every time I read this story, I kind of just see Guy Fawkes as the idiot in the wrong place at the wrong time. The barrels of gunpowder were going to be found regardless. They were something simmering beneath the surface, and only time would tell if they were about to go off. So let's go with that metaphor on this episode, since our shows all have powder kegs of their own, and let's see how many of them get lit tonight. Guys, we are about to play a fun game of how many times can I refer to foreshadowing as a barrel of gunpowder?
But we caught a cold and the streamer was years away. We only binge on old DVDs and season didn't last one day. Stop going in my seat, it was still a beautiful sight. Now I'm talking comedy now, and it's podcasting right.
Home Economics has Anthony Russo back for his fourth of 14 spots directing. His brother Joe has gotten a lot more mention on this podcast, but that's just because Anthony directed more of the earlier episodes. This is Lauren Pomerantz's first of two writing credits. Comedian Patton Oswalt guest stars tonight, and Patton will also appear in Article 2 of Parks and Recreation, which unfortunately aired after 30 Rock ended, so it's well beyond the scope of this podcast. But in that episode, Patton's character Garth Blunden filibusters, and he famously delivered, unscripted and completely unrehearsed, 8-minute-long speculation about what he wanted the recently announced new Star Wars movie to be about. This whole thing is currently on YouTube, and I'd pay good money to see the movie he just completely pulled out of his ass. Here on Community, we're double-dipping into two different arcs of unresolved sexual tension. Annie's love of Troy was really stuck in the backseat last week and was barely mentioned, but with Troy joking around with her early in the episode, it's coming back strong. Meanwhile, we thought Professor Slater may have been enough of a distraction for Jeff so he'd stop pursuing Britta, but the statistics professor is out of sight just like Guy Fawkes thought he was. Jeff is sleeping through Spanish class, and there's concern that something is wrong. Britta calls him out after class, saying he looks rough. Jeff is able to deflect as Vaughn is about to pass by. Vaughn is Britta's ex, who we haven't seen since social psychology several weeks ago. She feels bad about how their relationship ended, where Vaughn was humiliated in front of the entire study group, and she tries to apologize, but Vaughn doesn't want to hear it.
Late.
Can't we still be friends? Isn't the word later already short enough?
Despite Britta's objection, Pierce takes it upon himself to talk to Vaughn on Britta's behalf. We don't actually see the discussion, but we learn afterwards that Pierce and Vaughn did talk, and Vaughn gave Pierce a place in his band as keyboardist. This is metaphorical barrel of gunpowder number one. Shirley and Britta discover Jeff is now living out of his car, and the rest of the group discusses the situation in the library. We learn the significance of the show's title, Home Economics, when Jeff shows up to study group and admits he got kicked out of his condo because he missed payment on some fees. But he doesn't want or need their pity. But when Britta catches him looking at his condo's listing and he's obsessing over his Italian handcrafted faucets, she encourages Jeff to move on from his old life, because downgrading could actually help strip off his superficialness and turn him into a real person. So the pendulum is swinging back towards the will they in this relationship, and Jeff thinks that Britta just wants him to downgrade because she's attracted to bums. He can't revel in this moment for too long, since his car gets towed. Without any other options, Jeff shows up at Abed's dorm and asks if he can move in.
You want the top bunk or the bottom bunk?
Top.
Me too. Racing for it.
Boom!
I win.
The next day, Abed's eating cereal and watching cartoons, and asks Jeff if he talked about Brian Williams in his sleep last night. Maybe Abed dreamt that Brian Williams was going to audition for TGS. Jeff doesn't understand how Abed can be satisfied with this kind of life, but it's pretty simple. Abed's satisfied because he knows what he wants, even if that's just Lucky Charms and television. Jeff will only be satisfied when he figures out what he actually wants out of life. This is metaphorical gunpowder barrel number two. Jeff gives living like Abed a shot and finds the instant comfort in this lifestyle. With all the trappings of his former life gone, Jeff finally opens up a little bit. I've mentioned over the last few episodes that we haven't really seen a lot of depth out of Jeff, but when we get some glimpse into his past, we can see it's there. Jeff, much like Abed, was raised by TV, the best dad there is. Britta finds the pair dorming it up, and is impressed that Jeff is managing to survive without his Italian faucets, choosing a life of communal dorm bathrooms.
You don't sit on a toilet like that until you've left the material world behind.
I lived in a dorm for 2 years, and they will make you become resilient, both mentally and to many forms of bacteria. Britta has been dealing with her own issues in this episode. Vaughn and Pierce's band, Some Worries, gave their first performance in the cafeteria, and their song is all about Britta. I'd play it, but I feel like I might already be in a gray area with all these drops that I put in, so I'm avoiding music to prevent any sort of copyright strikes. But the song is all about Britta being a B, or a GDB, as Pierce sings it. And this is that metaphorical barrel number one blowing up. In Abed's room, Britta meets Abed's neighbor, Pavel.
Hey, bros!
And even he is singing Getting Rid of Britta. This sets up Britta to head off and confront Vaughn and Pierce to end this. Vaughn tells Britta he wrote the song because he feels that Britta sucks. Pierce takes offense to this, and he gets into an argument with Vaughn. There's a great moment of Pierce trying to escape all the keyboards that surround him, and Vaughn fighting with the cable from his guitar. I don't know if everyone finds this physical comedy as funny as me, but if you're following me on Instagram, you've seen where I record this podcast, and that scene is my entire life. So Pierce is actually offended because he thinks they both wrote the song.
Are you trying to Garfunkel me?
Maybe. Assuming to Garfunkel someone is to keep putting up with him, even though they're a fat, lazy cat who hogs the spotlight and eats all the lasagna.
Pierce gets himself booted from the band, and Britta, completely oblivious, thanks Pierce for what she thinks was defending her honor. Pierce has no idea he was doing anything good, so he improvises and pretends that's what he was doing all along. Britta thinks she's put out one fire, but now metaphorical barrel number two is about to explode. Abed asks Britta for help because he recognizes that Jeff is completely self-destructing. He tells Britta that the only thing that will motivate Jeff into fixing his life is thinking that he still has a shot at sleeping with her. This is too skeevy of a plan for Britta, so instead, she breaks into his condo and steals his Italian faucets, then brings them to the dorm. She tells Jeff that he's actually got nothing going on beneath the surface and needs to start getting back some material possessions to rebuild his identity. And then he can put those faucets in a new place. Jeff being Jeff misreads the entire situation and thinks this is just Britta's ploy to sleep with him. Out in the quad, Vaughn's about to go on stage. Pierce asks Vaughn to lay off of Britta, and Vaughn assures Pierce that he's moved on. He has indeed, and now the newest song they sing is about how Pierce, you're a bee. Vaughn's a little petulant, if you haven't picked up on that already. Jeff shows up, and he's pulled himself together, and he tells Britta that he's moved into a motel, and he's out apartment hunting. Abed shows up, noticing Jeff moved out. Jeff clues in that Abed only pushed Jeff out for his own good, and Abed would have been fine if Jeff lived there forever.
You're pretty cool, Abed.
You're a huge nerd.
I'll admit it, I got a little misty-eyed when Jeff hugs Abed to thank him, and Powder Keg 2 has been put out. So if Jeff's homelessness was the A plot, and Pearson Vaughn is the C plot, let me wind back to the B plot that's also being told tonight. Troy's been joking around a lot with Annie, and Annie is so in love with Troy that she's grateful to spend any amount of time with him. Leaving Spanish class, Troy asks Annie for advice on how to ask out someone special in class, and reveals that he wants to date Randy. Annie hesitates, and Troy apologizes for misleading her. Completely oblivious that Annie is in love with him, Troy mistakes her confusion.
Randy can be the name of a guy or a girl. And in this case, it is definitely a girl.
This just sticks the knife in a little deeper. Shirley catches the tail end of this and begins to push Annie into telling Troy how she actually feels. Let's call this gunpowder barrel number three. But Annie can't do it. Instead, she gives Troy advice for the perfect date, the one she wants to go on with him, and she even gives Troy her grandmother's blanket so he can use it on the date. Troy ends up making an innocuous comment, saying that he should have hung out with Annie more in high school, and her heart breaks. She's about to confess and blow up the barrel, but instead, in a rather Pierce-like move, she fakes a medical emergency, a bursting appendix. Troy has to rush Annie to the school's clinic. The nurse examines her and says she's fine, so Troy tries to leave. Annie then doubles down, saying it hurts everywhere. This leads the nurse to believe it's something much worse, and wants to quarantine Annie, and tells Troy that he needs to get as far away as possible. Troy says he's got a date outside, and the nurse says that's perfect, and hands him a strip of condoms. Troy thanks the nurse, then, holding the condoms, thanks Annie, and says,
I'll be thinking of you.
So Troy and Randy are outside listening to Vaughn's band, and Annie comes out, wearing just a Johnny shirt. She's got a torch to the fuse, and she's on the verge of telling Troy how she actually feels, but instead, she just takes her blanket back. She storms off past Shirley, telling Shirley that she doesn't want any more guff out of her. She made what was, for Annie, a huge move. Shirley acknowledges this and walks Annie back to the clinic, leaving this powder keg behind to blow up someday in the future. Pierce, meanwhile, is also in the crowd listening to the band call him a bee. Unlike Britta, Pierce is eating it up and is just happy that everyone is dancing to a song about him. Pierce has no shits to give. But in the tag at the end of the episode, we find that Pierce has hired a rapper to write a diss track, but Vaughn catches them.
Well played, Pierce. This isn't over.
Once again, episodes like this just have so much heart behind them. We see how much the study group is truly starting to care for each other. Shirley can't stand to see Annie slowly break her own heart over Troy. Abed recognizes that Jeff may temporarily be satisfied living in his lifestyle, but it's not what Jeff needs out of life. Pierce chooses Britta over being in the most popular band in school. This is such an understated episode. There's not many memorable quotes beyond the songs, but the jokes and the dialogue are super snappy. Jeff, Britta, and Troy Annie continue to evolve. Surely Pierce and Abed still have the least defined arcs here. Abed especially, who really hasn't had much in the way of character development since the very early episodes. But what the show is really excelling at, and it's only 8 episodes in, is making us care about the characters because they care about each other. That's really what this show is all about. I mean, it's right there in the title. It's all about community. So while Home Economics has mostly been about relationships that have yet to start, coming up on Parks and Recreation, we'll focus instead on the aftermath of breakups and divorce. Ron and Tammy was Troy Miller's first of 7 Parks directing credits. He also directed 3 episodes of The Office. This was also Mike Scully's first of 3 Parks writing credits. Scully is most famously tied to The Simpsons, and he served as the showrunner from seasons 9 to season 12. I think most Simpsons fans would wince at that, since that was definitely the transitional period after the end of The Simpsons' golden age. If the show still wasn't pumping out new episodes 20 years later, maybe this point of the show wouldn't be looked back upon so harshly. But, much like Guy Fawkes, I like to think Mike Scully was caught in the wrong place at the wrong time. And it's too hard to fault him when he was also responsible for writing some all-time classics, like Lisa's Rival, Lisa on Ice, Marge Be Not Proud, and 2001 Greyhounds. Nick Offerman's real-life wife and must-see TV alumnus Megan Mullally makes her first appearance as Tammy, Ron's second ex-wife. Megan, obviously most famous for playing Karen on Will and Grace, also made 3 appearances on 30 Rock as Bev, Liz's adoption agent. A few weeks ago on 30 Rock, we got the return of Devin Banks, a straight-up villain. On Community, the Dean and Chang are somewhat antagonists, but they're not villains. Last week on Parks, we met Greg Pakaitis, but he's not a villain. He's not malicious, he's just a punk kid. But Tammy Swanson is a straight-up comic book villain. She exists entirely to make everyone else's life a living hell. Parks and Recreation will play with the villain trope a few more times in the future, but Tammy is in a class of her own. Breakups are messy, much like treasonous plots to overthrow the British monarchy, as we'll learn tonight. And while everything may seem calm above the surface, there are a lot of powder kegs hiding under the surface here too. Mark Brandanowitz comes in with some urgent news for the just-renamed Subcommittee for Lot Beautification. The Library Department wants the land for a new branch. Of course, in the eyes of the Parks and Recreation Department, libraries would be dens of evil.
They're like a biker gang. But instead of shotguns and crystal meth, they use political savvy and shushing.
Anne briefly notices the body language between Mark and Leslie while they're talking in the hall. And she also mentions that she'd actually like a library that close to her house, but she'll never admit it to this group. Brandanowitz does have some information that could be helpful. The new deputy director of library services is Ron's ex-wife, Tammy. This will be Park's gunpowder barrel number 1. Ron's not surprised that someone as evil as Tammy is heading up libraries.
I honestly believe that she was programmed by someone from the future to come back and destroy all happiness.
Leslie's fired up and goes to confront Tammy, and she comes prepared.
In case something bad goes down, I wore my sharpest rings. This one will tear you up.
After all this build, we meet Tammy, and we see a much softer woman than Ron described. Tammy says that Ron tends to exaggerate about her, and in a show of good faith, she's cleared Leslie's $3 of late fees, because they're both government gals, and they need to stick together. After much discussion, Tammy agrees to drop her request and leave Lot 48 for the Parks Department. Leslie goes back to Ron to tell him that Tammy's changed, and maybe Ron should try to get some closure with her. Leslie lets it slip that she slept with Mark, and they're still friends, and this is just another reminder for us in the audience. Ron gets distracted by a change in the air, and he knows Tammy is in the building.
She's here, isn't she?
Ron heads out of his office, and sweet, unassuming Tammy asks if they can just talk, and they go off to get some coffee. So if it's been mentioned before, I've missed it, but Donna and Jerry are clearly established as having worked at the Parks Department long before Leslie ever had. Judging by Tom and April's reactions to Tammy, they've either met her before or they've heard enough stories. Donna warns Leslie that the divorce was ugly and she shouldn't have got involved. Ron and Tammy can't even get through 30 seconds of eating together before they devolve into a screaming match. They try moving to separate booths, but then they're crawling over the backs of the seats and exploding into a passionate embrace. I'm not sure exactly what moment we realize Tammy may actually be as crazy as the stories, but I'm guessing it's when she throws her bra from the car window as they're peeling into the parking lot of a seedy motel. Gunpowder barrel number one is exploding and the entire Parks Department is about to get turned to rubble. The next day, Ron's wearing a red golf shirt, just like Tiger Woods does when he's feeling invincible. And Tom tells us it's Ron's ritual every morning after he's had sex. This joke will take on an entirely different connotation in only 3 short weeks, and you know what? Let me just make a note to talk about this more in depth on the December 3rd episode, since that's an entire other huge news story from 2009. Ron says he's getting back together with Tammy, and he even thanks Leslie for sticking her nose where it didn't belong, which is a red flag that Ron is under incredible duress. Leslie doesn't pick up on it, and it's only when Ron gives her the day off so she can stop stressing about the lot that Leslie realizes that Tammy is actually using Ron, and that Ron is trading Lot 48 for more sex. Leslie catches Tammy on her way out of City Hall, and confirming that Tammy is a villain, she tells Leslie her entire evil plan.
Leslie, that's crazy. And correct.
Realizing the true impact of her actions, Leslie goes back to check in on Ron, and he completely breaks down.
I'm so screwed now. Her hooks are in my brain.
Yep.
She has all the power, and I have nothing. I'm so little.
So, Ron makes Leslie come along for the breakup, since this was all her fault to begin with, and they head to the library to confront Tammy. Tammy thinks it's hilarious that Ron had to bring Leslie to do the talking. Leslie can't put up with the manipulation and tells Ron to do whatever makes him happy, and she leaves. This actually breaks Tammy's hold on Ron, since Leslie's the only woman who ever put Ron's needs over her own, and Ron is fired up enough to go break things off for good. Tammy, in turn, breaks off part of Ron's mustache, and he comes rushing out 5 minutes later with the pushpin jammed in his forehead. Leslie and Ron regroup at the Parks Department, and Ron takes down his poster of a brunette with breakfast food and replaces it with a poster of just breakfast food. The spell is broken for now, and Ron and Leslie have a drink, toasting to exes staying exes. This ties into the B-plot for tonight. Parks and Recreation has finally figured out how to get Andy into City Hall, as he's going to run the shoeshine stand now that Old Gus...
I never ever liked being called Old Gus. I didn't understand it when I was in my 20s, and I sure hate it now.
...has retired. I'd like to note that Leslie refers to the building as Pioneer Hall, which is something I've never noticed before. Andy is now a daily presence in Brandanowitz's life, and every time he sees Mark and Anne, he openly flirts with Anne and makes comments about trying to break them up. Mark's getting fed up and goes to Tom for advice. Tom tells him to just play it cool and take the high road because Anne is classy and will appreciate it. Tom only ever tells people to take the high road.
Because then there's more room for me on the low road.
Mark tries to high road Andy, saying he thinks he's a cool dude. Andy is much less of a mastermind in manipulation than Tammy is, and can't believe that Mark doesn't realize that Andy's still in love with Anne. He couldn't be more clear about it.
Is punching allowed on the high road?
Ultimately, though, Tom's advice works when Anne confronts Andy, saying that Mark's being cool about all this, and Andy's being mean by just throwing it in his face. I guess score one for Brandanowitz. So, despite meeting the Burt Macklin version of Andy last week, we're back to the more creepy than endearing Andy tonight. Despite her anger at the end of the episode, Anne had been dropping hints all along that she thinks Andy is improving as a person. We're also seeing hints that Mark and Leslie's one-night stand hasn't fully been resolved, and since Dave wasn't mentioned at all tonight, you kind of forget that Leslie has a boyfriend too. Let's call these secret gunpowder barrels. And we're ultimately left with some undetonated ordnance. Donna is finally given some love tonight, but in turn, we don't see anything from Jerry or April, and Tom's relegated back to one or two scenes. I'm finding it a little strange that even with only four secondary characters, they really can't find ways to incorporate more than one or two of them into the plot for each episode. Parks has been developing more and more of an absurdist atmosphere that allows a character like Tammy to work. She actually helps develop some depth for Ron since he's been so no-nonsense. I will say, yeah, Tammy's abuse of Ron comes off way more problematic nowadays. Should this be played for laughs? I'm trying to figure out which side of the line of good taste this falls on, but Tammy's almost too cartoonishly evil for this to even be in the realm of anything realistic. Ultimately, Ron does break free and acknowledges he needs help to stay away from Tammy, which is a positive. I accept that I'm probably wrong about all of this, but once again, we're wincing at something from 2009 that felt pretty trivial back then. Oddly enough, when I was originally trying to characterize Tammy, comparisons to Disney villains kept popping in my head, and Cruella de Vil is the one I'm coming up with. Maybe just because she seems so sincere at first, but she is completely rotten beneath the surface. Maybe I just don't remember enough other villains to make a better comparison, or maybe I'm subconsciously still thinking about writer Mike Scully and how he also wrote 2001 Greyhounds, which was an obvious parody of 101 Dalmatians. So ultimately tonight on Parks and Rec, we've seen what happens when unresolved issues become explosive after a relationship ends. But The Office will help give us some insight into how explosive things can be during the breakup. Double Date was directed by Seth Gordon, his first of two Office directing credits. Gordon actually scores a directing trifecta, having also directed two Parks and a Community. He also directed one of my favorite comedy films, Horrible Bosses. I only bring this up because the last time I watched it, I said, "Is that Meghan Markle?" to my wife. In the exact same tone, I said it while I was rewatching The League. It's just strange that I've seen Horrible Bosses a dozen times and never noticed her before. This is Charlie Grandy's third of eight writing credits on The Office, and he also directed season 8's Mrs. California. And he's also credited as playing Dinosaur on the 30 Rock episode, The Rural Juror. I'm going to lay off the barrels of gunpowder metaphor briefly, even though, I mean, this episode is just a series of explosions going off. Instead, much like Guy Fawkes turning from terrorist to folk hero over the years, I'll be leaning into the metaphor of time-changing public perception instead. Dwight's brought in H&H bagels from New York, and as he hands them out, he tells everyone, "You owe me one."
Can a guy just buy some bagels for his friends so they'll owe him a favor which he can use to get someone fired who stole a co-manager position from him anymore?
So Dwight's latest scheme to ruin Jim will somehow involve getting everyone in the office to use their owed favor to turn on Jim. Michael, meanwhile, passes on the bagel because he had a fish stick sandwich for breakfast. In fact, he had to eat two fish stick sandwiches because his girlfriend, Pam's mother Helene, didn't want hers. What a shocker. Pam's been hoping that this relationship would just die out on its own. Pam's disapproval in The Lover only spurred Michael into dating her even harder. So Pam's just waiting for Michael to inevitably ruin this one on his own. Spoiler alert, he will very quickly. But for now, Michael's hoping that he can win Pam over with an extravagant birthday lunch he's scheduled for her mom. Helene shows up to the office, and Michael, cognizant of Pam's feelings, is trying to keep things very low-key. He's been making a present in his office all morning, and he tries to hide it. But then Helene reveals that he also bought her a necklace, which he gave to her this morning while she was sleeping. Michael tries to avoid sharing all the gory details.
Yeah, the rest of the story has been censored due to inappropriosity.
Because of sex?
Hey. Kevin!
Pam fakes an emergency call about a missing paper delivery to get out of lunch. But Jim recognizes this trick as one of his own and won't let her off the hook. This does worry Creed, however.
Something's up. That paper was never supposed to arrive.
At the restaurant, Michael's actually done quite an amazing job at decorating for Helene's birthday. While Pam is teasing her mom about pretending to be 49 again, Michael does some terrible back-of-the-napkin math and eventually has to be told that Helene is turning 58. We end up getting two different sets of perceptions, swiftly changing all at once. Michael's been so wrapped up in this relationship, he actually hasn't thought all that much about Helene's age. But he quickly realizes that this is going to create a huge disconnect between them. Michael asks Helene all sorts of ridiculous questions. Like if she'd ever compete in a triathlon, like he wants to.
I'm definitely going to do it. I've already got the run and the bike thing down. Just need to learn how to swim.
There's a season 7 cold open where Oscar teaches Michael how to ride a bike. And all over the internet, this is called out as a plot hole. Because back in season 3's Benihana Christmas, Michael rolls into the office on the used bicycle he's about to donate. Now there's this debate as to whether he's riding it or just rolling on it. But he clearly states here that he can bike, but he can't swim. So I think this ends the debate. Season 7 is definitely a plot hole. I digress. While Michael's perception of Helene is shifting, Pam's perception of Michael is shifting. Michael's original plan is actually working, and Pam realizes how happy Michael makes her mother. Helene opens a scrapbook that Michael spent all morning working on, which includes things like the penny Helene threw in a wishing well for good luck. Now, last week, when Michael mentioned he also fell into a fountain at the Steamtown Mall, I'd say that's in reference to him trying to get back this pay. So, along with the koi pond, Michael has fallen into two fountains in the last 30 days. Pam and Jim are completely won over, but Michael is in full-on crisis mode.
Home run, Michael.
You set the bar so high.
That was a bunt.
The Office plays these moments so well. Michael's not being shallow. He's been looking for someone to start a family with, and that can't be Helene. However, he has absolutely no emotional depth to handle this properly, and he immediately needs to end this relationship before it goes any further. He tries to use Pam as an excuse, but Pam says that she, much like the British with Guy Fawkes, has changed her mind.
Wow, you've really grown.
So with little other recourse, Michael breaks it off because she's too old, leaving them all to drive back from lunch in one very awkward car ride. Back at the office, Dwight's been laying the groundwork for favors. But Andy comes into the kitchen and shows Dwight that he polished his suitcase. Andy reveals that he has to return favors immediately.
Do not test my politeness.
Which sets off Dwight and Andy into this out-favoring each other competition, which the entire office and us at home are left to watch awkwardly. Andy is ultimately worried he'll die before he can repay Dwight's favors, so he gets everyone to chip in on a $15 Starbucks gift card for Dwight to repay him for the bagels from earlier. Dwight's distraught that he's now wasted his entire day with this plot.
I could have grown poison mushrooms that'd be this high by now! They're mushrooms. I don't get that high.
With Michael, Pam, and Jim back from lunch, Pam's now even more pissed off at Michael than she was in the first place. Michael just wants things to get better between him and Pam, and he's willing to bribe her for it. Desperate and listing off ways to fix everything, he asks Pam if she wants to hit him. She does. In the parking lot, after work, in front of everyone.
I'm gonna hit you as hard as I can.
So the thought of Michael getting hit really creates a buzz in the office. Michael wasn't too worried at first, but Ryan and Kelly tell Michael that Pam's full of crazy pregnancy strength. Michael asks Jim if she's really that strong and pleads with him to stop all this, but Jim's washed his hands of this entire situation. Toby checks in, just to confirm that Pam's gonna hit Michael off of company property, and gives her all these pointers on how to throw a really hard punch. Although, isn't the parking lot actually company property? That is where Michael hit Meredith, with company property, on company property, double jeopardy. Everybody's waiting to see the hit, and when Michael finally comes out, he tries to send everyone home. But they're here for the show, and Kelly's even brought popcorn. Michael, terrified of getting hurt, blurts out an apology for everything. For dating Helene, and for dumping her on her birthday. Michael promises not to date any more of Pam's family members again. But, for the record, Helene came on to him. Okay, so I've avoided explosion metaphors so far, but Pam slaps the ever-loving shit out of Michael.
Are you okay?
No!
You're okay.
Back upstairs, Dwight puts a frozen chicken on Michael's face to help keep the swelling down. And Michael says, He owes Dwight one. Dwight, finally scoring a usable favor, asks Michael to fire Jim, or to promote him to tri-manager, or to give him an office. Michael refuses, and Dwight tells him to keep his stupid favor. So as much as I brushed off Ron as being the victim of abuse during Parks, we see more physical violence here. Honestly, I'm just trying to laugh at these shows. Why does this shit keep coming up? We're back to Dwight trying to bring down Jim, while the Michael Helene arc comes to an end. Meanwhile, there's no co-manager friction between Jim and Michael like there was last week, and Andy's way too focused on Dwight to try to hit on Aaron. Mafia to Double Date have not been a great string of episodes. In retrospect, the alignment of these four series airing on one night seems to have started during one of the most notable lulls in The Office. Jim vs. Michael and Dwight vs. Jim have been playing out since the start of the season, but we never really see both play out at the same time. Even Michael dating Helene really only showed up in two episodes, and now that's over. I can't help but think about fireworks, this being November 5th and fireworks being the tradition. Fireworks shows are loud and colorful, but they only last for a couple minutes, and after it's over, you'll say something like, "Remember that one that was neat?" But they're ultimately kind of forgettable. That's how I feel about these episodes of The Office, in that we've just been stuck. It came up during Review of the Reviews last week that 30 Rock's fourth season had soured on a lot of critics. And that's my personal feeling on this stage of The Office. The Lover had some amazing acting, but otherwise, things are just feeling a little lackluster. So without commenting on where The Office goes to next after this episode, let's just move on to 30 Rock to see if the critics will continue to hate it. Audition Day has Beth McCarthy Miller back as director, having last directed Into the Crevasse. This is Matt Hubbard's 8th of 17 writing credits, and he also wrote two episodes of Parks and Recreation. The Seagull, a play by famed Russian playwright Anton Chekhov, comes up a few times in this episode. I had never heard of this play before, and after reading the Wikipedia article about it, I understand that it's about subtext. I might be missing the point. Regardless, most of us without literature degrees probably still will recognize the phrase Chekhov's gun. Chekhov was a big believer that everything you mention in a play should be necessary. So, for example, if there's a gun hanging on the wall in the first act, it absolutely must be fired before the end of the show. It's not quite foreshadowing, not in the same way that I've been illustrating so far with my allusions to gunpowder barrels. It's more like, if you make something noticeable, it should be for a purpose. So let's keep the idea of Chekhov's gun in mind as we move through this episode. Season 4 opened with Jack telling Liz to find a new cast member for TGS. And after many weeks, Liz and Pete have finally found Jaden Michael Tyler. And now, all they need to do is convince Jack that Jaden was his decision. Pete's employing something called the Hornberger system, where they set up this ruse where they'll audition four bad candidates alongside Jaden, making him look even better by comparison. Liz feels bad about all this, duping everyone into thinking they'll have a chance, since she remembers what it's like to go out for an audition and get rejected. This is our first gunpowder barrel tonight. Pete says at least Jaden's dreams are going to come true, and at Liz's age, she should be glad that she's making a man happy.
That's true, Liz is old.
Jack overhears only the last part, while continuously scratching himself. And while it's an action and not an object, this is a Chekhov's gun, since something this distracting must be on purpose. Jack tells Liz she needs to ditch the emotions and start acting like a robot when making decisions.
Human empathy. It's as useless as the Winter Olympics. This February on NBC.
And we'll call that gunpowder barrel number two. Cold open over, and we've already got two barrels of foreshadowing and one Chekhov gun ready to get fired. Also, here's my weekly reminder that Jack is a proxy for NBC leadership, the same people who thought Leno 5 nights a week would be a great idea, and are already trying to convince people not to be excited about the Winter Olympics. Jenna's not even gunpowder. She's straight up nitroglycerin, considering how worked up she's been for the last several weeks. She finds out the set is closed today and realizes it must be for auditions. Tracy's not fazed, though, since they'll just hire some skinny white guy, and he won't be a threat to either one of them. We should all feel nervous when Tracy is the only voice of reason. Jenna gets the audition list from Kenneth, and she's terrified to learn that Jaden Michael Tyler is auditioning. Jenna and Jaden have a history. They've worked together and were best friends until he betrayed her. Jenna tries to warn Liz, but Liz brushes this off as Jenna continuing to derail the process. But this is actually foreshadowing Gunpowder Barrel number 3. Doc Com, who we learn has played Trigorin in Chekhov's The Seagull, wants to audition. I'm calling this Chekhov gun number 2, even though we think this is only a throwaway line. Liz shoots Doc Com down, saying they're only auditioning outside talent. Doc Com calls his mom to tell her the audition fell through, and I've already lost count, but a couple Gunpowder Barrels blow when Liz, falling prey to her emotions, lets Doc Com audition. Pete's upset. The Hornberger system works because of its simplicity.
The more people you add, the less effective it is, like a neighborhood dad garage band.
Or, just like Vaughn's band when he added Pierce. Even worse, this is just going to open the floodgates, and now everybody, from Frank to Brian Williams, wants to audition. Jenna's on a new mission and needs Tracy's help again. They can't let Jaden get on the show.
He's evil, Tracy!
He's evil, Tracy? Oh, he's evil, comma, Tracy.
Trey's not convinced. Not until he finds out that Doc Com got an audition. Tracy's seen his Trigorin, and unlike a skinny white guy, Doc Com is a legitimate threat. So, if I'm tracking properly, this is the second Chekhov gun I mentioned firing, since this inspires Tracy to actually help Jenna out. Jenna and Tracy go out recruiting, and they end up bringing back Kalandra and a group of funny gay people. Okay, no, sorry. They're
Filaria!
Liz is fed up with Tracy and Jenna and tells them that Jaden isn't crazy. He's got referrals from Martin Scorsese, Christopher Walken, and Gilbert Gottfried. And I should mention, this is another Gunpowder Barrel of foreshadowing. Jaden arrives, and he's just happy to be here. He's such a fan that he gets Liz to take his picture in front of the TGS sign. To try to keep track, let's just call this Chekhov's camera. Jenna tells Tracy that she'll freak him out.
I'm going to walk up to him and say the 4 most vicious words you can say to a person you've already met. Nice to meet you.
And that freaks people out, huh? This is a learning and friendship adventure.
But her plot is immediately foiled when he says, nice to meet you, to her first. Tracy tries the technique himself on Doc Com, and lo and behold, it actually works. And Doc Com gets so wrapped up in his own head that he blows his audition. Now before we get to the rest of the auditions, let's wind back to what Jack's been up to since we last saw him scratching. Kenneth can spot immediately that Jack has bedbugs, which Kenneth recognizes since they were rampant in Stone Mountain. And if you were screaming at me in the last episode, I realized after uploading the podcast that Stone Mountain was established as Kenneth's hometown all the way back in the 3rd episode of season 1. We never do learn if Jack caught the Chew Daddies in Georgia or if they're the regular New York variety. But again, another Chekhov's gun has been fired, and Jack's forced into a teleconference since the rest of the board is scared due to the current bedbug epidemic taking place in Manhattan, which was a thing that was really going on at the time. I'm actually not sure if it's ever stopped. Jack goes to the dermatologist, but is forced to take the subway since he can't use the company car and no taxi will accept him. After being shunned on the subway, when Jack gets back, he is worried about being a pariah and asks Kenneth for a hug. And even sweet Kenneth won't come close.
Et tu, Kenneth?
Kenneth replies in Latin, further proof that he is immortal. The bedbugs have driven Jack to change, and now he has empathy and feelings, and he won't let Liz turn anyone away from auditions, which forces Pete to lay out everyone in a perfect order for Jaden to still be Jack's pick. From the auditions, here's some highlights. Josh, who quit back in the premiere, shows up to audition, desperate to get back on TV since his movie career flopped. Josh was always clearly playing a Jimmy Fallon type, who, like I mentioned last episode, had a rough patch after leaving SNL. Unfortunately for Josh, I don't think he'll end up finding his way into a long and successful tenure on late night talk shows. Kathy Geiss auditions by singing I Dreamed a Dream, a reference to Susan Boyle, who became incredibly famous, seemingly overnight, earlier in April of 2009, when she was a competitor on Britain's Got Talent. Toofer and Lutz audition together, and this throws off Pete's entire number system, so he has to run out on the street to grab a robot street performer to fill in a spot. I've completely lost track of my Gunpowder Barrels and guns, but remember when Jack mentioned being robotic? That was very important. Finally, Jaden auditions, and he does flawless impressions of Scorsese, Walken, and Godfrey. Liz realizes Jaden lied to her about the references, and when she confronts him, Jaden blackmails her, using the Chekhov camera from earlier. It's got Liz's fingerprints all over it, and he'll claim that she took pictures of his weird genitals, Liz finally realizes that Jenna was actually telling the truth about Jaden. He is crazy.
Would a crazy person laugh like this?
Liz wants to pull the plug on the entire audition and goes to ask Jack to start over, since everyone is crazy. But Jack says Liz's job is to manage the crazy and to pull out the talent, just like she does with Jenna and Tracy. And it turns out Jack actually hired the robot, the only person who would shake his hand after learning he has bedbugs. Liz, relieved that she doesn't have to hire Jaden, is semi-optimistic about the robot.
Boy, I hope he speaks English.
This was another very gag-heavy episode. I found myself having to pause every minute or so for note-taking. And I'm still not sure if I caught every piece of foreshadowing or all the instances of Chekhov's gun being used. Overall, there was so much going on, with so many guest characters showing up for one-line gags. But most of the jokes land, which is good. We don't see a lot of emotional depth in this show. Definitely not as much as we do in the other three series. Liz's confession to Jenna that she was actually right is pretty subdued, and Jack never apologizes to Liz after his change of heart. It's all pretty shallow emotionally. And maybe that's why 30 Rock is resonating with me just a little bit less than Community Parks and The Office. It's not an overly intricate plot, but just watching the jokes get flipped around and played over one another again and again makes it truly hilarious. In a stark comparison to tonight's Office, this isn't anything like watching fireworks. Really, this would be like lighting the fuses on 36 different barrels of gunpowder, then trying to figure out in which order they're going to blow up. So heading into tonight's final segment, now that we've finally hired a third cast member, it'll be interesting to see how the critics reacted to this episode. Let's review the reviews. Starting with Community, Home Economics scored a B+ from the AV Club's Emily Todd Vanderwerf. A slight step down since last week, but still great nonetheless. The episode's theme of accepting where you are draws a parallel to Party Down, the short-lived series that aired for two seasons in 2009 and 2010, and starred Adam Scott, who will be making his way to Pawnee, and, coincidentally, guest starred Megan Mullally in the second season. The reviewer considers Community to be a more positive series since, unlike Party Down, no one here is really ready to admit they've given up yet, which is why they're still at Greendale. Jonah Krakow of IGN gave the episode an 8. Again, I'm noticing he enjoys episodes where Jeff is the focus, but he does point out that Jeff and Britta's relationship hasn't grown too tired yet since they really don't focus too much on innuendo. He's not as impressed with Troy and Annie, saying the whole story was telegraphed from the start. I guess, but considering how much we've seen Annie come completely unhinged when talking to Jeff for the last few weeks, I was kind of expecting less restraint from her when she steals her blanket back. But at this point in the series, we're picking up steam and looking for the inevitable redemption of Jeff Winger. Matt Fowler of IGN gave Ron and Tammy an 8.8, with the statement that every week is getting better than the last. Leslie, for once, finally gets to be the voice of reason in an episode, while it's Ron that's gone completely off the deep end. Something I've never picked up before that this review does is that whenever Ron talks about his ex-wives, we've always expected it was his gruff demeanor that turned them away. But it turns out that Ron's actually a pretty big softy when it comes to love, and he just has terrible taste in women. Thankfully, Ron's storyline saved this episode, since not much was going on with Mark, Ann, and Andy, other than getting Andy into City Hall. The AV Club's Steve Heisler scored this episode an A-. A score indicative of really giving supporting character Ron Swanson a big piece of the plot. I've never reflected on this, but this is the deepest we've dug into Ron at this point. It felt natural to me, I guess, but it's interesting to see the 2009 perspective on this. The reviewer states that Mark and Anne are just too normal and would benefit getting the same treatment that Ron got in this episode. And really, they're just the tip of the iceberg. I'm waiting for Tom, April, Donna, and Jerry to get the same attention too. IGN's Dan Phillips scored Double Date a 6, which I expected based off the review of last week's Koi Pond. The Office has hit the wall, and he says the issue is in the execution, with Michael coming off as cruel. Phillips points out in this review that he's starting to agree with fans who find it very easy to dislike Pam, so I guess the sentiment was brewing even while the show was still on the air. This episode is a misstep, considering how much work the show has done over the years to make Michael likable and Pam his usual defender. Nathan Rabin of the AV Club gave the episode a B. He's the same guy a few weeks ago that mentioned that a coworker tried to date his sister, and now he also claims that he was dumped on his birthday. So I guess he's some sort of office oracle. Regardless, he cuts through everything that happened in the episode and summarizes it in a way I couldn't. Nothing was ever at stake. Pam's mom was never going to be Michael's true love anyways. So when it's over, it's just over. Nathan also reviewed Audition Day, and he gave it a B-, which is an improvement from the previous weeks, but the lowest score from the AV Club tonight. His main complaint is that 30 Rock used to be a show about making TGS, but now it seems to just be a meta-referential show about making 30 Rock itself. This seems like a matter of taste. And again, he references that the show is no longer able to deliver quick-paced, laugh-out-loud jokes. I don't get this complaint. Do you know how hard it was to summarize this show and to try to narrow down what jokes actually make it into the drops that I play? Come on, dude. Robert Canning of IGN gave the episode an 8.2, meaning 30 Rock finishes second to Parks from IGN's perspective. This episode is chaotic and funny, and while Jack's bedbugs bit wasn't really funny at the start, it continued to build and build, and watching the impairment force Jack to become empathetic does eventually work in the end. The main difference between IGN and the AV Club seems to be that IGN at least acknowledges the jokes, but states that they just don't hit knockouts. That's a little bit my take on the whole night. Nothing was quite a knockout, but other than The Office really spinning its wheels tonight, everything was pretty funny. I myself am cursed with future knowledge, so I'm always expecting just a little bit more out of these episodes. Let me go back to the barrels of gunpowder that were sitting below the House of the Lords some 404 years earlier. I know there's some big booms that are just laying in wait on these shows. In retrospect, I forgot how subdued Tammy was in her first appearance. And if you don't watch Parks, running naked into a motel room is pretty low-key Tammy behavior. Community is still an early episode of Community. Meta humor was Community's biggest appeal, and that really hasn't started showing up yet. And I'm guessing the AV Club's gonna hate it, like they hated on 30 Rock. Also, there's news coming very quickly about Dunder Mifflin as a company that is about to change the rest of the season, and really, the rest of the series. Things are about to blow up, in a good way. That being said, hiring a third actor on Audition Day is the ignition point that 30 Rock's been working towards all season. And now we'll have to see where they go next. I think it's been the best episode of 30 Rock that I've covered so far, and the same can be said about Parks with Ron and Tammy. So where do we go next? I'll be back in 2 weeks. We're looking at November 12th, 2009. On the schedule, we have Community's Debate 109, Parks' The Camel, The Office's Murder, and 30 Rock's The Problem Solvers. This has been Comedy Night Podcasted Right. You know the spiel by now. Me, Matt Kale, does it all. I hope you've enjoyed this adjustment to the format. Research and writing seems to have gone a lot faster this week, and I'm just as happy with the result. And I'm hoping, after I edit this down, that it's at a pretty reasonable runtime. If you've got any feedback, questions, or just want to drop me a line, you can email me at comedynightpodcastedright@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter at comedynightpod1 or on Instagram at comedynightpodcastedright. At this point, I'm most active on Reddit, username Comedy Night Podcast. And you can also check out the subreddit I've created for this podcast at reddit.com/r/comedynightpodright. So why don't I have a consistent name format across every social media? Well, I researched and made sure that Comedy Night Podcasted Right was a unique name so that I wouldn't get confused with any other shows. But I never considered that it's 25 letters without the spaces. And it's way too long of a handle for most services. And I'm still very annoyed that Twitter threw a 1 on there without asking me first. So, I usually find a drop to leave on, but instead, I'd like for you to enjoy this cover of Getting Rid of Britta, originally by Tom Wolfe, Eric Christian Olsen, and Chevy Chase, as reimagined and covered by yours truly. Lates, I just want to take this time and speak from the heart, tell you how I feel. Saying goodbye to Britta was the hardest thing to do. When someone's a bitch and a liar, ain't nothing left to woo. Getting rid of Britta,
she's gotta go.
Getting rid of the bee,
she's a no good bee.
Getting rid of Britta,
getting rid of the bee.
She's a GDB.
Shake it, Pierce.